Loading up the cannon today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. When we discuss education, literature in particular, what do we mean by the canon? That's at issue today on Scribble. I should mention at the outset, we're talking about the 1N canon, not the 2N canon. 2N canon is what nations use when they fight. The 1N canon is what departments and universities use when they fight. Were there arguments about the canon when you were head of the English department?
Right in the middle of it, whether there should be one or not. I grew up with the canon, in case some of you still don't know what a 1N canon is, the best example is the Bible, right? The 66 books out of all the possibilities. There were, in fact, 5 different books of Revelation, but it took a committee to decide that John's revelation was the one that ought to go in and where it ought to go in. So that's the biblical canon.
Yeah.
That most Christian churches follow, but not all, right? And even there, between Catholics and Protestants, there are differences.
Yeah, the 1N canon, that's a Greek term, I think, that it means something like a yardstick or a way to measure something. And what exactly are you measuring when you set up a canon? The limits of orthodoxy, or how would you define that?
Well, I would think it would be what it means to be a culture, right? Here are the books that if you want to be an American or British or a German, you need to be familiar with. The great works.
That's in literature. That's
in literature, right.
So it's really a series of books rather than a series of propositions and so on?
It's a series of books. And in fact, as I said, during my tenure at Augustana, the canon simply went out the window. My mother taught the canon, which in her case for high schools in America was Longfellow, William Cullen Bryant, Hawthorne, Thoreau, Emerson. I mean, they were the biggies, right? That was what students learned. Scott Forsman's text was a text that almost every place in the country used. Some states, even today, Texas and California, if you get a book adopted by Texas or California, they adopt books for the whole state, right?
Yeah.
And this is the book that every high school senior in California will read.
Well, you know, the thing is, that when you give that list of men, right away somebody would say, dead old white man. And so why should that be the canon?
It shouldn't be.
Why not?
Because the way in which our canon, Longfellow and others, the dead white men, was an admissions ploy by Harvard University. In the late 1880s or thereabouts, Harvard put out a letter to high school seniors, or high school students, and they said in the letter, if you expect to get entrance to Harvard University, you need to be familiar with the following works. And those works were Longfellow, Bryant, Thoreau, Emerson, the dead white guys. Right. Mm-hmm. Of course, Shakespeare, and of course, Dickens, and Silas Marner, and several others. High schools had no canon until that letter came out. And suddenly, high schools started saying, well, if we want our students to get into Harvard, we better start teaching these works. And then colleges like Augustana, which had no canon before that time, started saying, well, if Harvard is requiring these works, they must think they're the great works. We don't want to seem to be slouches secondhand to Harvard, so we started teaching it. And so the canon was born for essentially no reason whatsoever, except that Harvard University said those were the great works.
Would you say that there are no, there isn't a list of essential works that every educated person ought to know or ought to be acquainted with?
Well, yeah, I you know, I wish you'd talked to me about this 50 years ago when I was certain about things. What I am certain of is that lots of people get left out. A couple of weeks ago for this program, we interviewed Shelley Moore Guy, and her story is what's wrong with the canon. She said, you know, she grew up in Rock Island High School, got a perfectly fine education, read Longfellow and all the rest. And she said, well, I would like to be a writer, but I can't write this stuff. And then suddenly she came across a couple of black poets, Nikki Giovanni and others, and said, my God, I can write this kind of stuff, right? The canon did a disservice to those black students who were talented but didn't think they belonged in the canon. And from Harvard's perspective, they didn't.
You know, I think back to my father who left school at the age of 6, because by that time he had learned to read and write and could handle math. And he went to work supporting himself at the age of 10, pardon me, age of 12. Later, when I was in high school, some of my classmates, when we finished 8th grade, they finished their education because they felt no need for it. And in those days, it was an accomplishment if you went to high school. The only people who went to college were those who were wealthy or those who were so brilliant that they found a way to get them in. Then after the Second World War, the president and his advisors decided to solve the perennial question of what do you do with all these returning veterans? In years past, they were just thrown onto the job market, and most of them had nothing to do. Gave them the GI Bill, they could all go to college, and that changed everything. Literally changed. The World War II not only changed our idea of what constituted an education, it also almost created adolescence. Prior to that time, you went to work just as soon as you could. But then we figured, well, kids are adolescents, and so they don't really get into the job market until after college. If you're going into factory work, high school will do it. Well, factory work has just about disappeared. So I look at World War II as making a pivotal change in a lot of things about American life. But the big thing in my mind was college, that all of a sudden college became the objective where it had not been the objective for most American families before. And that's where you encounter all the heavyweights. You know, it's true, in high school we had literature books that had particular prescribed readings, excerpts from all sorts of people. But you get into college, and that's where the fight over the canon really becomes intense, isn't it?
It did finally become intense. I think the colleges adopted the same canon that Harvard adopted early on. I mean, they would have said the same thing. Incidentally, not in the Harvard list were Melville and Whitman and Mark Twain, three of the great, I would consider, great American writers today, because, of course, they didn't fit the canon.
But you have to choose something because you can't read everything. I mean, at the hundreds of thousands of books that come out every year, and that's been going on for a while.
I don't know. One advantage of the canon is that students coming to me in 1960 shared a culture.
Yeah,
I could talk about a scene in Silas Marner. They would all groan. In 1958, I think, Silas Marner was voted by American high school seniors the worst book in the world. But they had all read it.
Yeah.
They had all read Shakespeare, and they'd all read Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. And so here were a group of students from Chicago, from New York, from California, from little towns, from farms, and they shared a culture, a canon.
What's the problem with that?
And I went through a period where I began to, the problem is it leaves out all sorts of writers that ought to be in, that are worth reading and that should be read. It left out Black writers, Latino writers, other image. You know, when I came to Augustana, the image of America was still the melting pot.
Yeah.
Right? And that's from a scene in a play in the 1870s in which American workers, there's a scene in which there's a Bessemer steel vault, melting steel, and on one side of the stage in walk all the workers from in their native costumes from all the different places in the world that workers have come from. When they emerge on the other side of the melting pot, they're all wearing overalls and carrying lunch buckets, right? They've melted. That also turned out to be bogus.
Oh yeah, boy, that is bogus.
And by the time I was in mid career, the correct image, politically correct image, was a patchwork quilt.
Yeah,
and because people retain their cultures, they retain their past, they retain their language. They retain their names, or should? Or should they? Should we all melt into one big American thing? Or is our strength the fact that we are so diverse? And I think our strength is in our diversity. That's the mistake Hitler made, right? He thought these American soldiers will never do anything because here's an Italian, here's a so-and-so, and he's not well-disciplined like the Nazi soldiers. Well, he discovered that didn't work very well.
Two things. The Nazi soldiers got by because they made early use of uppers. They would feed soldiers drugs, and to the terror of the French, the German soldiers fought 36 hours straight. Then they collapsed.
Yeah.
And they took some more drugs and went on again. But also, the idea of strength and diversity goes against basic biological stuff, where animals are only comfortable when they smell somebody that's in the herd. It's true that our great strength is rising above that need to all be the same in the herd and accept one another and rejoice in diversity. But man, is that turning out to be hard.
More than accept, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, use. And in the same way that you know, if your nose got jealous of your ear because it couldn't hear and tried hard to be a nose, it couldn't be a nose. You know, it couldn't be an ear, and it would make a very bad nose, and you'd, you know, stop smelling things.
Yeah.
So I went through a period then in mid-career where I decided we needed a canon, but it could be any 15 books, but should include Black lit, it should include Latino lit, it should include, you know, lit from around the United States. Didn't make any difference which the books were as long as there were 15 books.
But what should you pull from reading different books? You know, the problem with changing the canon, and I'm not arguing against that, but you pull one book out. In order to put another book in, you have to pull one book out.
That's right.
And who is to say that somebody's writing is more valuable than another, or that one particular book can teach you things that are essential to know that another book may not do as efficiently. How do you make those choices? What are you looking for when you put together a canon, when you say, okay, I'm going to teach literature, and these are the books I'm going to teach?
You're looking for a book that teaches or inspires in you the feelings and the values of that particular culture.
Well, what is the culture then? Is the culture what happens to be right now, or does it rest on a long-standing pillar of the past? You know, when you start thinking about how we think and so on, you wind up going back to the Greek philosophers, Thales, Anaximander, Anaximenes. You get on up to Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Those guys, they started something that was absolutely brand new, thinking about things in an analytical way, and that had not been done before. What do you do with those guys? Do you read their works? Or are they only to be read in a course on philosophy?
Well, you aren't going to get everybody to read them, right?
No, that's true. They're tough.
I suspect there are a lot of people that never did read Silas Marner.
I read it, and you're right. It was a chore, although in retrospect, it was a very good book.
The only advantage was that I felt in my 26 students from all over the United States and some from Europe that they shared something. They were a cohesive unit before they got here because they had been familiar with the canon. By the time I in the mid 80s, the only thing I could say that everybody would recognize and laugh at is a student would walk in and I would say, "Nice Cosby sweater."
Nice what?
Cosby sweater.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. They all knew what I was talking about. But I could mention Romeo and Juliet, and half of them wouldn't have any idea.
Well, so is it better to start from this lack of cohesion than to have a group that has some kind of basis for literature?
Well, I came here this morning to find out from you, Don. But here's another problem. The Harvard University's canon was almost entirely New England writers.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it turns out from the very beginning, less so today, American writing has always been have a regional flavor. New England is this brooding, introspective, religious literature. Southern literature is gothic, horror fiction, Poe down to Faulkner, down to James Dickey's Deliverance. Western literature is expansive, mythic, open, the cowboy, and so forth and so on. And Eastern literature is Henry James and T.S. Eliot, very sophisticated, owing a lot to Great Britain, educated, learned, and so forth. And then you get this great Midwest, which really has influenced, by the 1920s, was really influencing the rest of American literature, the realists, Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. And Hamlin Garland and Sinclair Lewis. I'm from Missouri. Show me, that mocked fun of all the other regions.
Yeah, you know.
So is the canon two books from each region?
I don't know.
Well,
I have no idea. I mentioned to you before. I don't know if I have in this air when I was ready to quit teaching at Alleman. I'd been teaching senior English, the very thing we're talking about, and I was burnt out. I told Father O'Connor I was done. He said, "What would it take to keep you?" I said, "Well, give me your brightest students. Let me teach them anything I want. No tests. Everybody gets an A. Maybe write a paper at the end of each semester. Yeah, give me that and I'll stay." And all he said was, "What'll we call it?" And I got that class. And that meant I had to devise, what it was I was going to do. I called it humanities. I picked eight classic books and eight modern classics. And I met the kids at the end of the junior year. They were going to be in the class. I said, "Okay, here are 16 books. If you're smart and have the time, you might start reading them now because we're going to be talking about stuff in the books." And what we did, when we came to class, I'd pick a topic. I remember one in particular, what is heroism? What is patriotism? And from what you have read, what can you tell me? What's your idea of that? And the whole class consisted of discussion and argument around those things. And if there was something in particular, like the legend of the Grand Inquisitor in the Brothers Karamazov, which is one of the books, we went through that in class just to be sure everybody got it right. And then we talked about that. What did that mean? And I can't tell you the name of those 16 books to this day.
Right. But you created a mini canon.
I did.
And a mini culture in that class.
That's right. That's right. Right.
And that class, by and large, has stuck together. I mean, that has worked.
50-year anniversary, the class asked to meet for their own anniversary.
Right.
And I was stunned at the achievements of those kids. But the thing I prized most, I was always afraid that I'd been influenced by my teachers. I grew up wanting to be like Father Gresham. I didn't want anybody to want to grow up being like me. And when the class was over, one member of the class registered as a conscientious objector. Another entered the Army. I thought, fine, my work is done. They're all individuals.
Right.
And that's all I ever wanted, for them to be themselves, but to think, to be able to think. And that, of course, thinking is the whole purpose of education. But you do need tools to think with, and works of literature are tools.
I still go round and around about the idea of a canon. Can there be a culture that is truly multicultural? And I would like to say yes, because to me that's part of diversity, is part of the great American experiments. But on the other hand, a canon does work when it works, and it works very well. And it worked for my mother and the students she taught. And so it avoided women writers, avoided black writers, it avoided other things, but it did work.
You know, even if you celebrate diversity, and I absolutely believe in that, you know, I've talked about Teilhard de Chardin, who talked about, he said the whole purpose of evolution, you know, was to diversify, to get as diverse as you could, explore every niche that the world has to offer. But then comes consciousness, and with that, the whole business of evolution has to turn around and come together. And he said to celebrate differences, and he called it, you know, aspiring to heights, to the omega point, in an atmosphere of love. Because in an atmosphere of love, you can accept diversity. If you don't have that, then you become tribal. And while you may think your tribe is wonderful and marvelous and the very essence of purity and charity and all, if it's just a tribe, yeah, you're not doing the job. And this country aspires to something that almost seems impossible. We want to make a nation out of diverse people by celebrating diversity. And yet all around us in politics, we find these tribal instincts. People want to make the country Christian. It's never intended to be Christian, as some countries want to make their countries Muslim, others Jewish, in India, Hindu. I mean, those are all regressive steps. And yet you find, I don't know what it is that's impelling people to turn to these tribal instincts. So the great American idea of diversity is constantly challenged.
I think you were right a few minutes ago. It's built into our genes.
Yeah, it is. It is. We like to think that we are so separate from all other creation. And yet you can find some of our genes in plants, for Pete's sake. A chimpanzee is just a few genes shy of being a Homo sapiens. We are built on this stalk of life that has in it so many rules, you might say. And one of them is this tendency toward tribalism. We all want to look the same, act the same, think the same. And that way lies madness. It really does. But yet it's a compulsion. But in our intelligence and our self-awareness, we know that that's not good. The earth is a very, very diverse place. Unless we want to kill one another, we have to find a way to get along.
We do a pretty good job of that, too.
Oh, God, boy, do we. I mean, it's just, well, that's a different kind of canon. But the whole business of handling diversity and yet bringing us together as we celebrate diversity, I don't know how to do that. I don't think anybody knows how to do that. The whole idea of this country was we would be a nation of laws. If you follow the law, that's all it takes. Otherwise, you are perfectly acceptable no matter your You know, the color of your skin, your ethnic background, your religious belief doesn't make any difference. Because I don't, and I've always believed that. I think you're free to think anything you want, but I have a keen interest in the things you do. Because if you decide, you know, in your particular culture or religion that killing other people is good, well, then wait a minute. I think we better have a little talk about this. So the canon and diversity, maybe you have an insoluble problem there, Roald.
I haven't been able to solve it, and I certainly won't.
What you mean? You mean we've wasted a half hour?
No, but I, you know, nevertheless, here and there, there are good books and great books, and getting someone to read them along with you, you know, that's where I am at this point.
Yeah, it's true. And I think, you know, I started, as I'm sure you did, I started tinkering around with, well, what would I set up as a canon? Which is very hard to do. My canons tend to be very short. They're only about three books. I think if you read these, you know, then we have a thread of thought, a set of propositions that we can talk about. Well, the important thing is not just to read the books, but to talk about them.
Well, to read the kind of books you're talking about, you already have to have had a culture of some kind, and that... You know, I think the problem today is getting people to read.
Okay.
The average person in the United States reads 3/4 of a book a year.
3/4 of a book. I've done that, but
yeah, no. So canon schmanon, right? I mean it.
Yeah, the problem is getting people to read. I'll agree with you there. And I don't know how you solve that.
Well, should you get them to read the three things you think are great, or is it okay to let a seventh grader read modern photography just so he can read? English teachers, believe me, have debated this back and forth, back and forth. Is it just read anything, comic books, get him to read?
Yeah.
And my mother would have been horrified. I had to read science fiction under the bedclothes at night with a flashlight because she disapproved as an English teacher of science fiction.
Heinlein's pretty good. And
they're all very good. I mean, there are some great works of science fiction.
One of the great works of science fiction is by C.S. Lewis, The Great Divorce.
But it wasn't in the canon.
No, but it is a great work of, I won't call it theology, although there's some of that in there. But you read that book and you are transformed. I think the only thing you can do is to have a good eye for books and try to inspire others to read them. And, you know, you may succeed, you may not. But you're right. The whole problem is just getting people to read. And shouldn't that be the purpose of this program?
I hope.
Well, I don't know that we solved anything for anybody today, but we've certainly had a chance to talk about it. Let's come back next time and talk about some specific books.
All right.
That maybe we would recommend, and don't know we'd call it a canon, but some books I think you might find interesting. That'll do it for now. Don Wooten with Roald Tweet. Thanks for listening. Back next week, we'll fire another canon on Scribble.